back about it. And if you're sitting at home, you're just shouting to the walls. When you have a program at WBAI, you can alert them about Donald Trump.
That's David Rothenberg. Tune in to any Saturday, Saturday mornings from 8 to 10.
This is a well-oiled promotion, please.
What's up, everybody? I'm John Leguizamo, and you got to listen to me having a great conversation with Marcia Pendleton, one of the great backstage stories.
That's Saturday at 1 p.m. on WBAI New York.
Greetings, Pacifica members. This year, the month of June brings three different election activities to the network. We urge you to vote, and you can also run as a candidate if you choose. First, the nominations period for the 2021 Local Station Board Delegate elections is now open and continues through June 30th. Second, you should have received an email, postcard, or paper ballot to vote in the bylaws referendum. Be sure to vote by July 7th. Third, a proposal to amend Pacifica's Articles of Incorporation has been published for your review. For more information about all of these important choices, visit elections.pacifica.org. You can leave a voicemail for the election supervisor at 510-993-0320.
This is Wayne Kramer from the MC5. Nobody kicks out the jams like WBAI New York.
Well, I feel pretty good, and I guess that I could get crazy now, baby.
Thanks to you.
Thank you for thinking of me. And I thank you.
And I thank you.
Let me say thank you to all you people out there.
I want to thank each and every one of you for coming by.
And while he's thanking those folks, let me take this opportunity to thank all of you, our listeners and support staff, our contributors, our interns, the volunteers, producers, and the entire crew that works countless hours to bring WBAI into your lives.
This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, an interview conducted but a few hours ago with writer and critic Terrence Taylor. But first, a review from Dan Persons. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, and this is my Hour of the Wolf review. The new Irish horror film, Caveat, which is now available on demand via Shudder, commits a variety of sins. The premise is that Isaac, played by Jonathan French, is asked by his friend Barrett, played by Ben Kaplan, to watch over his adult, paranoid schizophrenic niece, Olga, played by Layla Sykes, on an isolated island, the one condition being that since Olga is afraid of people entering her bedroom, Isaac has to be locked into a harness which is attached to a heavy iron chain, which is attached to a bolt, in the basement of the rapidly decaying house. So right there, there's a what-could-go-wrong, don't-feed-the-mogwai-after-midnight vibe that feels maybe a little too obvious. The mise-en-scene is relentlessly grim, with a production design that suggests that Olga's home isn't so much a house as a pile of black mold into which an oven has been installed. A drumming monkey toy figures prominently in the plot, and it's been over-designed into a creepy prop that no real parent would give to a child unless they were prepared to pay for a lifetime of therapy. There are too many shock scares for my taste, and writer-director Damien McCarthy seems reluctant to decide whether this is psychological horror or supernatural horror, straying one way or another over the line, but never really fully committing to either side. And yet, for all its flaws, I'd be lying if I said I didn't enjoy Caveat. The interplay between all the actors is quite good. Director McCarthy plays out quite well the cat-and-mouse game between Olga and Isaac, which grows more dangerous as time progresses, and the reveals of secrets behind Rose's family history, and why the memory-impaired Isaac in particular has been recruited for this task, are nicely placed, with quite a few surprises. And McCarthy may overplay the creep zone aspect, but it is creepy, and the director can frame some unsettling moments, like the sight of Olga in a state of schizophrenic paralysis, hands covering her eyes, the reveal of something, I won't say what, hidden behind some wallboard in the basement, or the ever-popular staple of surreal fantasy, the hand emerging from a wall. And it's that latter image that I think lends a clue to what McCarthy was aiming for with Caveat, a kind of David Lynchian slow boil intensity. But the thing with Lynch is that he fully commits to his carefully sublimated, disturbing ambiences, to the point of risking antagonizing an audience. McCarthy isn't so bold, and the result, as with the confusion between the supernatural and the psychological, is a film that doesn't fully commit to its surrealness. Which is a shame. With a more full-hearted embrace of its strangeness, Caveat could have been a distinctive exercise in horror. I still quite like it, really, but I wanted to love it. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Thank you, Dan. Terrence Taylor has been a frequent guest on Hour of the Wolf through the years, but the pandemic and some physical issues he's been dealing with have gotten in the way. So we set up a Zoom session and recorded, well, way too much material, but that's okay. As a black writer of horror and speculative fiction, not to mention as an all-around pundit, we may record some more for next week's show, which just happens to fall on Juneteenth. But for now, here's part one. It is the earliest morning, or pretty early, of June 12th, 2021, at 12:46 a.m. And with me is a valued and frequent guest on Hour of the Wolf, Terrence Taylor. But he has not been on since the beginning of the pandemic. But say hi, Terrence.
Hello. I was sitting here. We're recording this on my iPad, and I felt gas coming and could not find the button to mute myself. I have to figure that one out before the next time we do this.
You need eye gas for that.
It's gone away, though. I somehow magically starting to talk has made me go back into balance.
I think
so. Hello.
Hello. So, pardon me. So, who are you?
I am. You know. I've asked myself that question so many times over the years. I am currently a novelist and short story writer who also has a review column in Nightmare Magazine quarterly. So I encourage people to read that. Yes, called Read This, where I basically review two books a column. And but books that I pretty a recommendation column with the critical aspects in that I break down why I find the books of interest and why they may be of potential interest to other readers.
So but the main thing is positive reviews, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You're not reviewing stuff you find.
No, I'm only reviewing things I like. I'm reviewing things or things that I think that I will like and have luckily so far have liked everything I picked. I'm fairly selective, and basically when I'm looking at synopses and categories and descriptions, I've gotten good from a variety of publishers across the board just at picking out things that appeal to me. So my new column just got turned in to John 2 weeks ago, and I just got the check, which I actually should open. But that it's worth reading. There's two very interesting books in it.
For point of disclosure, I also work for John Joseph Adams as an audio editor for the three podcasts, one of which, Fantasy Magazine, Terrence is the host.
I've been narrating lately and practicing my vocal skills at not being an irritant when people hear me. I also have written two of three vampire novels in an unintended but now, I think, complete trilogy, because I actually have the first draft of the third novel. I have to go back and do an extensive rewrite, but I know what it is, and I'm going to enjoy that greatly. And I'm working on a mid-grade sci-fi novel with a friend that I am now nearly halfway through the first draft of. We wrote the story together and developed a couple of chapters, and then I've basically been writing the first draft because he's working on an animated series. But the funniest thing was, so we were talking, months ago, and he had the brilliant concept of putting it in first person as opposed to third person present tense, and that it transformed everything. I brought chapters into the crit group, I'd gotten feedback, I'd rewritten them, it was moving along, and that was the last thing, and it started the ball really rolling quickly. And I basically am a more experienced writer of fiction and prose than Frank, as Frank is a far more adept and experienced graphic artist and does just who doesn't, as I don't think about how I write in a particularly major way. I just sort of accept that that's what I do and don't view it as special because I can do it. He's the same way with art, but he has these amazing things. So I suggested that I write the first draft of the book because I could shape it, give it a form, and then we could rewrite it together. So we'd written the whole outline beat for beat over months. And I started writing, and I was sending chapters to him and pasting it to a master document. He was looking and going through and making notes and making changes and sending things back to me. And at a certain point, he got really, really busy. His mother had passed away. He really couldn't even look at the thing. And we had a conversation where he said, God, I feel really guilty. I feel really bad that you're doing all the work right now and you're doing all the writing. And I started laughing. Because I said, wow, I've been feeling guilty because I've been doing all the writing and having a great little time at that. And I felt like I was excluding you from that part of the process. I have no problem with this. If you don't mind me just running to the end and writing 22 chapters and then we go at it with an axe, I can keep going and get this first draft done and we can go and play with it. And I just find it hilarious that the two of us have spent the last 3 months feeling guilty that the other was doing something that they felt they shouldn't be. So it's gone great.
Some big name professionals have worked that way.
You know, it's. I think collaboration is something I do very rarely. There are very few writers I've actually collaborated with successfully. Bill Trady was one. I could sit in a room with Bill any day and throw things around. His first writing credit was four scripts we co-wrote for You Can't Do That on Television, and I wasn't going to do it.
A great, great show, if people can find it anywhere.
It is Laughing for Kids. It was basically when I was approached to write for it, basically it was the pitch to the producers. God, I haven't thought about them in ages, Roger and Jeff. And when they approached me, they were like, it's like basically comedy for 10-year-old boys. The grosser, the better.
Was this for NET, National Educational Television?
Educational, I'm sorry. That's hilarious. It was a Canadian producer.
PBS, right?
No. PBS existed. My first show had been Veggie Soup, and I did this afterwards. It had been around for a few years before I came on to it. It was produced by a Canadian production company and two producers from there under the Canadian Writers Guild, which is why I was able to work on it, because we have a collaborative relationship, the WGA and the Canadian Guild. And I basically, it was aired on Nickelodeon. I believe it started Canadian TV. It was aired on Nickelodeon. And one of the funniest things that happened was after I started hanging out at NERSIF and Fantastic Fiction, at one of the dinners, I think I was talking to
These
Terry.
Are both reading series in New York.
Both reading series both, in New York.
Both of which are available on YouTube.
The funniest thing to me always was that when I got to New York and actually finished the novels, got an agent, got them published, started writing, continued to write, and basically lived out my midlife fantasy, which was to come back to New York and finally finish the novel I've been poking at for 20 years and write fiction. I never allowed myself to commit to it, because sitting in a room alone making up stories is what my parents used to chase me out of my room for doing. So I always felt guilty that this was wasted time. But at any rate, Bill went on to amazing success in sitcoms, co-creating Big Bang Theory, Dharma and Greg. He's now Big Bang is done, and now he's just shooting it all the way. He's just having so much fun. He's just trying all these things, developing all these different projects. So, but I got to work with Bill first. I got to write four scripts with Bill. They had approached me. I'd done, I think, about four already. They approached me about writing four more, and I was like, and I'm talking to Bill. I say, I don't know, you know, it's like they want 60 gags. It's 60 sketches. It's like a 60-something page script. Each one's like a page, but they take what they want. They throw out 20 of them. They throw in two, and they put their name on it, and I had to fight to get a credit. I don't know if I want to do it anymore, blah, blah. And Bill was like, wait, no. Let's do them. I can get a credit. Let's do them together. And I'd been hanging out with Bill for a couple of years at that point. His first wife was one of the stars of the second season of 3-to-1 Contact. So I met him when he was this programmer who found TV interesting and ended up getting an internship at the Muppets that just took him to where he's always wanted to be. And he's one of the smartest, funniest people I know. So I can actually say I got there are people who'd kill for what I had that weekend. So because Bill's point was, look, the two of us can sit down with the drinks. We can knock these out in 2 days. We can knock out 4 half-hours in a weekend. And I was like, you're right. It's gags. It's sketches. It's bump, set up, middle, payoff, punchline. Absolutely. And we did that. We sat there. We went through four scripts. We knocked out all the gags. We had index cards. We'd come up with the jokes. We'd figure, because you had different categories, different characters, and different specific running gags. There, the diner, the parents, there were certain jokes that were characters that were regular parts of the show. And then there was a joke wall, like Laughing. So we would do X number of sketches for each of those segments. We wrote them out. We created a stack of index cards. So he at the time was working. I worked freelance, so I wasn't actually in an office. He's the one who's got me started on a word processor, bless his heart. He looked at me cutting and pasting a script that I'd done on the Selectric one day with literal tape and said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm cutting and pasting. I don't want to have to retype the whole page. I just changed the parts that I need to change and just tape everything together and Xerox it and send it back to them. And he said, do you know what a word processor does? And I was like, what? And he said, that's a word processor. You don't have to do that by hand. So he got me turned on his Tandy Radio Shack computer at his place. So I sat there writing the script on this little screen with these green letters, and I just take the card, I write it out, take the card, write it out, get the whole script done, something happens because I do a lot of rewriting and it always stresses whatever program until now that I would ever use in the first 10 years of this. I could crash a document easily. And unfortunately, if you crash a document on a Tandy Radio Shack in 2000, it wasn't coming back. And I just watched it disappear. And my heart, I was like, no, that script was done. I had one done. And I called Bill up and he was like, okay, stop. He said, sit down. He said, go to the living room. There's a bar, get a shot glass, take a shot of Wild Turkey and sit down. I did that. And he said, okay, here's the thing. You can't get it back. He says, but here's the programmer's rule. Never curse lost data. He says, you know what you did. You know the jokes. You know what you wrote. You can get it back and it'll be better. And I was like, okay. And he was right. I have an incredible memory for story. And I knew the dialogue in my head. There were one page scripts. I went back and reconstructed the whole thing within 2 hours. But it was a big lesson for me in many, many things that day. Not how not to take an axe to a friend's computer after it eats something you've been working on. And just how much fun Bill and I had.
And next time, don't buy a trash 80.
Yeah, well, but that was what there was. And, you know, I mean,
in them days, I was on the Atari 800.
Well, but
and those things for Bill, happen.
For Bill, with what he had available, that's what he had. He had, I don't remember why particularly, but, and maybe I'm even wrong about the computer, but there's no other reason for that name to be in my head. But, you know, he was a kid. He was 20. What do you want from him? You know, he didn't have a job at that point. His wife had a job. I mean, he had the best computer he had. But the bottom line is I learned how to do word processing. It changed my life. The Selectric got stolen by my neighbors because they didn't like a black man moving to their block, you know. And basically, it got me my first Mac, 512K, and I never looked back. But, wow, thank you. That was a lovely little bit of nostalgia. That was a little journey. So that's who I am.
Okay, very good.
20 years of kids script writing, my midlife crisis was horror fiction.
You left out Sherlock Holmes in the 25th century.
Well, while I spent 10 years in L.A., I resisted writing children's television at first until I ended up realizing that was ridiculous. And once I got an agent who handled kids' scripts and I started working. Spent 2 years in development because if you're really good at throwing ideas out spontaneously, which because I'm so wildly ADHD I am, they would drag me to pitches with the networks because anytime the the executive would say no to something, I would come up with five other things. And the thing is, if you're good at that, they don't let you write scripts. They just want you developing series and going to pitches. And I did that for 2 years, and it's like, no. I can't keep building bombs. We never explode. I've created five series, and no one's made them yet. I can't keep doing this. And basically, I once made the mistake of saying that when I was working on Livewire, it was a teen talk show in Nickelodeon, and we had a guest. Each show had a theme. One time we had a guest who was a nuclear physicist. She was a nuclear physicist. She made bombs. That was the science she worked in. She was in a nuclear missile program, and we have her on. I don't remember who else was on. I don't think it was the same show with Isaac Asimov, but there were wonderful guests on that show. And so whatever the theme was, she fit into it. And I was talking to her in the green room after she finished her interview. And I said, does it ever drive you nuts? And she said, what? I said, you're creating these devices that are amazing and have this incredible potential power. I mean, isn't this why you guys test it? Because you just got to see one go off every now and then. I mean, it must drive you nuts to be able to build something and never see it work. It's like when I was in development, I kept writing scripts that no one was ever going to see. And she looked at me like, what kind of monster are you? I said, no. I'm not saying you really want to blow things up, but you never get to see your work in action.
The potential is that both of you could end up with bombs.
Well, and ultimately, mine could even be more destructive than hers. So all things considered, there were some of those shows should not have been made. Trust me. But some of them had enormous potential.
Yeah. Sure.
But yes, no. And that's how I got started on computers. So yes, my writing partner and I in L.A., I worked with a woman named Eleanor Burian Moore for several years, and we did a lot of different things. But one of the things we did was, I think it was actually four episodes of Sherlock Holmes in the 22nd century, which...
Oh, 22nd, that was off by 300 years, okay.
Yeah, it's so perverse because it was basically, the idea was that after Reichenbach falls, Holmes's body was preserved in a barrel of honey, which the Egyptians used to preserve many things, but it's a preservative. So in the 22nd century, they somehow find it, but they basically they clone him and make a new Sherlock Holmes, who evidently, or they revive him, but he has all the memories. They give him a robot that does on-site lab work that is his Watson, and it has Watson and initials or something. And we were basically supposed to adapt the stories, the original stories, into that time period. Huh. And, you know, we more or less succeeded. Some were more successful than others. The Crooked Man got a little interesting because, of course, it just ended up being about coding largely, as I recall. But, yeah, it was fun. So, okay, two things. You write in children's television, you're always dashing from job to job. You very rarely get feedback. No adult you know, unless they have kids, ever sees anything you do. So you have a 20-year career where no one you know actually knows what the hell you've been doing. But every now and then, you run into someone who watched it. So at one point, I'm sitting at Channel 13, and this young woman next to me turns and goes, your name's Taylor? I said, yeah. She says, did you write a show called High Feather? And I was like, what? How do you even know that? After Vegetable Soup, my first job for New York State Education, they did another series called High Feather, which was a 10-episode series on nutrition. Low budget, basically Yana Brandt, who sadly is no longer with us, Judy Seeger and I sat at Yana's apartment one day and came up with the series, created it. The grant was there. We needed to come up with a way to teach nutrition. And after we sat there for a few hours, I said the thing that I was to spend the next year regretting, which is I said, oh, summer camp. And they were like, oh. I said, yes, varied backgrounds, kids put together with no choice. They come from all different places. You have a nutritionist and a nurse at the camp. So we have a cafeteria. Everything would work for us to be able to use all the, it gives us everything we need to teach nutrition. And it worked beautifully. But then we had to shoot it. We had to spend 8 weeks in Mayapack, New York at a summer camp in the middle of summer just shooting this for, oh, my God. And it was, there were so many stories I could tell, which I shouldn't. But
and let's not go there.
She loved the show. Her and her brother watched every episode multiple times and identified with it. And literally everything we had tried to do with the show was exactly what they got from it. It was amazing. When I was in L.A., I would go into meetings and I would talk to people. They would look at my resume and they go, oh, you worked on, you can't do that on television. And 30-year-olds would turn into 10-year-old boys. Well, they would tell me how much they loved that show.
I remember that show. I loved it.
It was hilarious. Think of the fun it was to write.
Like two of my favorite shows.
You have to know how much fun it was to write them. Because you write it and then they would shoot the thing fairly quickly. And they had a great cast, Moose. I mean, they had a hilarious cast. I think we actually got two of them in at one point for Livewire, but I didn't get pictures with them. I didn't ever really meet them entirely. I never went. They never brought us to Canada to watch the shooting. But yes, but that was it. And every now and then you'll just there was a third example of something like that. But there are these moments where you realize that there was a point to all of this and that you did things that actually did affect people's lives and made them look at things differently. And it's why I was so glad that everything I worked on was so deliberate. I was very fortunate that the producers I worked with, large number of them in educational TV, but even the studio people, there was, because by the time I got to LA in 91, a lot of what we'd been doing with multiculturalism and diversity had started seeping into mainstream Hollywood in kids' TV because there was a mixed market there. And we could play with things, but there was a value system in place. There were things you didn't do, and there were reasons you didn't do them. So, yeah, I miss those things. But then I got to write horror where I could just do any horrible, nasty, terrible thing I wanted and create characters that were appalling.
So to move along, how did you get back into prose?
I had been writing prose off and on, and we're concerned about time because we do want to talk about shows. How much time do we have left before
I'll wrap this up.
That gives us time for what we have to discuss. I'll wrap this up in the next five. When I was in high school, I didn't write. I had edited the high school magazine for two issues. I wrote like one piece for it. I always was into story. I read copiously. I read science fiction. I read horror stories. I watched horror movies. I read comic books. I read things that a kid my age at that point would not have read. I read a lot of mythology. I read the blue, green, and red fairy books. Mm. So I was well-versed in classic European fairy tales. I didn't get to African folklore until later because they weren't printing it much then. But I read The Golden Bough. I read, Bullfinch's mythology. I mean,
Those are the things that I read. I didn't read much more.
Yeah.
But everything else you've mentioned are still dear to my heart.
But the thing is that there is an overlap. When I was reading the horror stories, and even the science fiction stories, we're going back to what Campbell talks about with the hero's journey. All of the stuff that Campbell talked about is stuff from the books that I just mentioned. Joseph Campbell. But everything he talked about was in The Golden Bough, in these books. And he never said it was original material. I mean, he was codifying it and explaining how things had been structured since time immemorial. And so for me, there was very little difference between the pantheon, stories of the pantheon of different gods from different countries in Bullfinch's mythology and, Ray Bradbury. I never really read much Asimov. But science fiction, horror, I mean, all these things, I could see the correlation between them, between how the stories were structured and why they were structured that way, and the intent. Part of the issues I have with horror after the 80s, particularly film, partly probably also in literature, I don't read as much horror as I watch, but the reason I was attracted to horror as a kid was I had a very dysfunctional childhood. I had an abusive parent who I now have a wonderful relationship with and who has literally apologized, which I never thought I would hear after 10 years of therapy. Oh, that was an amazing day. He's an amazing man. And we literally say, I love you at the end of every call and I actually mean it at this point. But that was a long journey to get to. Mm-hmm. But as a child, black family, GI family, he was an Air Force military guy.
And where are you living at this point?
All over. We bounced from base to base. The longest we were in one place was in France from first grade to fourth grade. Before that was Texas for 2 years, Ohio for 2 years.
Oh, you're an Armed Forces brat.
Air Force brat. Air Force brat. So Dad was a navigator. We bounced around. I grew up in a haunted village in France called Evreux. If you Google it, Wikipedia.
I told you this. Maybe it is from me.
I may have told you because I found out about it when I was doing PR research to give them my life story for the first novel.
Do a whole other show just about that.
I can tell you stories about Gobelin, the demon of the woods. It's a fascinatingly weird thing, and I'm still convinced that because I didn't remember the house interior much when we went back 20 years later in the 80s, we went to Evreux and I found the house I used to live in. And knocked on the door with these two French-Canadian girls who were traveling with us to as far as Madrid to save their train ticket. And she thought it was wonderful, took us inside. They still had a poison caution sheet that was on the inside of the mirror in the bathroom that was left over from the Air Force. The Air Force had left NATO. When NATO left, the Air Force left. French military took over the housing, and then they sold it off privately. So we had a lovely little chat, with my little French-Canadian translators. But I realized I only knew the living room where the radio had been. I used to listen to radio drama. One of my vivid childhood memories is listening to an adaptation of a Ray Bradbury short story. I can never remember the title, the one with the Martians invasion. Was it Boys Grow Seeds in Your Grow Mushrooms?
Boys
You
Can Grow Mushrooms in Your
But it's the one where the parents are hiding in the attic at the end and these blue shadows are coming up to get them because the kids have been talking to aliens all this time. And I guess the parents would eat the
Boys
mushrooms.
You Can Grow Mushrooms in Your Cellar.
And before church, there was a radio drama, and I sat there in my church clothes in the summer with the sun streaming through the window, just warm and refusing to leave till the last line of that story was read. That's when I became a writer. I think that experience of listening to that story said, if I could do what's just been done to me, I think my life would be right. And I didn't do it for years.
Have you since then reread Bradbury?
Oh, yeah. I haven't read Bradbury in a few decades. I read Bradbury well into my 30s and 40s. I read the last works. I got to meet him at a library he used to type in the basement of in Torrance, California, because my friend brought me over because he lives in Torrance.
And of course, he was on Hour of the Wolf.
And he did benefits. So I got to get books signed by him. But Bradbury is... There's a bit of a fake quality to it, but I'm sorry. The man is a masterful poet. He's got
a
gift with language that he uses words in a way I've not known anyone else to.
He was, for those who don't know, a member of the Lovecraft Circle when he was
that I didn't know.
Yeah, absolutely. When he was a young teenager, he was writing in Lovecraft's zine, which was more or less run by Sonia Green, Lovecraft's ex-wife, who's also been on Hour of the Wolf not long before she died in about 1972. And Bradbury was sort of a mascot of the Lovecraft circle, along with, you know, huge big names, Hans Stephan Sanson, Clark Ashton Smith, you know, all those people.
And nice.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nice. But that explains a lot about him and his work. I mean, because it was incredibly mature at an early age. That would actually make a lot of sense.
Yeah, yeah. My problem with Bradbury is that growing up, he and Asimov and maybe Heinlein, juveniles, and Theodore Sturgeon were growing up in the 60s my favorite writers. And what I have discovered is that certain of those writers, Sturgeon holds up, but Asimov and Bradbury, now it's not true of all their work, but some of their work, when I reread it, Bradbury waxes almost a little too poetic at times.
You know, I know what you mean. But the thing is, it's still magic for me. It's like, I mean, it's Shakespeare. Shakespeare's old
stories like
time.
I mean, one of my favorites, which is an obscure one, is called The Pedestrian.
Don't you know the title?
Okay, it's a guy.
Is that the one where the person's on the street dying and these people that he sees everywhere are now gathering around him and they're watching him die? There's one horrifying story he wrote like that.
Yeah, no. This is one guy in a police car.
Okay.
And that's it. And he's just walking along the street late, you know, at night, having wandered from his house, and a cop car picks him up and tells him to get into the back. And he's asked any number of questions. He can't see who's talking to him from the front, but they drive him home and say, you know, you should not leave your home. It's unsafe. And they dictate a number of rules. Okay. And as he gets out of the car at the end of the story, and it's a very short story, he takes a look in the front of the car and there's nobody there.
Ooh.
That's the whole story. It's simply the authoritarian state will be mechanized.
Well, we're not far from that. I mean, they're talking about self-driving cars. Why not self-driving cop cars?
It's great science fiction. It's great dystopian writing. And that of his stories not only holds up today, but is au courant.
Well, you know, I mean, I should actually go to my shelf, pull down a few things and reread them. The stories that strike me were the ones that weren't specifically genre, but were at their heart, the Mexico stories in particular. The one I always remember is the one of the wife and husband visiting Mexico, and they visit the catacombs where these bodies have been tied up because the families couldn't afford to pay to keep them buried. And she's horrified by this.
Do you not know
this story?
Oh, I do. Let me explain.
But that one got the biggest impact. And in the end, she dies and he's leaving Mexico. And it's clear that he's not going to pay to keep her in the ground. And she's going to end up in the catacombs.
It
was that psychologically. That's the Bradbury that I
have not traveled much in my life. But in 1963, when I was about 11 years old, I spent a month and a half in Mexico with my family. And about a month of that was in Mexico City, and a week and a half in Tosco, and then a horrifying half week in Acapulco, waiting for them to bring us back. Acapulco, one of the most horrible cities in the world.
Well, I've been there. The main drag is horrible. You get off it, and the surrounding area wasn't bad. It was very nice. We got a crafts fair. We had nice restaurants, but the tourist part is
well, this is the 60s, and my point was I couldn't find anybody who spoke Spanish.
Everybody spoke English
with a Long Island accent.
You have to go far off to get that.
I went to those catacombs.
I didn't even know where they were.
3 years before October Country came out. And so when I read October Country, it wasn't just my mind's eye. I had been there. With the mummies, with the open casket mummies.
I've seen like photos and footage, but I've never. Where is it, though? What city is that?
I don't recall. We were in Mexico City, and we probably traveled like 90 minutes to get there.
The October Country, though. That's right. That's what that was in. I think I've got a copy of the. That's what I should reread. Just
a record album of dramatizations from October Country.
There was a TV series of dramatizations from his stories. I mean, stuff that was
Gregory Theater. It's still available.
I know. It wasn't terribly wonderful to me, and he was sort of a funny host to have. I mean, he was a wonderful writer. He's a funny
fellow. Tradition.
He just seemed like your neighbor. You know, it's just like, why is Bob hosting a show?
When he came to New York for the 40th anniversary of Fahrenheit 451, so he could receive the National Book Award, he came to WBAI. We did an episode of Hour of the Wolf, which I often play. And he's your neighbor. He and Fred Rogers would get along just fine.
Oh, that would be a funny evening. And so we should get to some of the other stuff
television.
I only have two quick stories in terms of the things you don't realize you have an impact on. The 22nd Century Show, hilarious. We wrote this thing. We thought it was going to go nowhere. Deke was doing this thing. Found out it has a huge cult following in England. And they love the show. And somehow that came up somewhere online. And they were like, oh, my God, I love that show so much. Each one had a theme. They said, you want to do a show on divorce? And I went, oh, my God. I said, my parents had the worst divorce in the history. Man, that was like maybe one of those painful periods of my life. They said, I said, no. Oh, no, I'm doing it. I got to write a half hour, 60 jokes about divorce it was one of the most wonderful purgative experiences to write a show with jokes on divorce for kids of that age. Oh, my God. So one of the jokes was the teacher is like the class head of the classroom. And it's like, okay, class, put down your pens. And they're like, no, we haven't even had the test yet. We're still writing down our names. My parents have gotten married so many times. My last name is too long to get on a single page. And that was one of the jokes. The other was the parents come in and do something my parents literally did to me, which was to say, son, your mother and I are separating and we're going to get a divorce and you have to decide who you're going to live with.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah. They actually backed me up against the back of a station wagon in Virginia and asked me out on the way to church. I didn't answer. And I just went home to New York with mom because at least she wasn't whipping me with a belt. I have the kid looking one to the other and then pick up the phone and go, hello? No. The kid, they said, who do you want to live with? The kid looks at them and he goes, is there a third choice? And they go, oh, blah, blah, and they hump her out and he picks up the phone and goes, hello? Social services? I'd like to report an abandoned kid. You know, and it was, but I got to write a half hour of that. So evidently, at the time that it came out in the 80s, just considered a little too touchy for Canadian audiences. They released it in the States, but it didn't play for five more years in Canada. And I was like, you've made me so happy. I loved writing that show, but that it was so honest that they refused to air it for 5 years. You've made my day. Anyway, so speaking of television, What do you want to start? Which means we have 4 minutes to actually.
Yeah, well, it says you're restricted with three people or more. Now, will the two get cut off?
Oh, this is like a science experiment. Well, possibly not.
Well, if we get cut off, we'll start again.
There we go. Okay, so let's start. I didn't realize there was three or more. That's interesting. That makes sense. Let's give it a shot. I think we can keep going.
Okay,
so,
I think begin. It's a possibility. You are tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. This program is Hour of the Wolf. My name's Jim Freund. We now return to our conversation with writer Terrence Taylor. So, one of the main things that I wanted to talk to you about was the pandemic slate of comic book and genre science fiction programming, some of which has been shockingly good.
And I don't know why you say shock. Well, yeah, there were some weak things. Okay, go on.
There were definitely some weak things, but
that would make you think this year was much better. But they've also hit their stride. I think I'll get into that later.
As far as the Marvel ones are concerned,
yeah,
I would.
Yeah, I just watched the first episode of Loki the other night, and I'm in. You know, that's why I
enjoyed it. But
I freaking loved it. I want to see where that goes.
Of the three Marvel shows, I would say so far, and we don't know where it's going to go, but so far it's the weakest of the three. But if you watch the first two episodes of WandaVision,
wait till we catch up to second Loki variant who's killing everybody.
Yes,
I'm thinking it's going to get much more interesting. In the same way, WandaVision first episode wasn't necessarily sold. Much more sold on Loki from the first episode.
Yeah, well, that was the thing, is that I found WandaVision to be one of the most happily subversive shows I have ever seen.
Well, shall we talk about that first? That would roll the conversation off.
I would say so, because
I have much to say about that, and want to make sure we talk about that before we get to anything else. I don't want us giving that short shrift.
Okay.
Shall I launch my opinion, or you want to hit your opinion first, and then we'll throw it back and forth?
Do yours. Go ahead.
I watched the first episode. I really didn't know that much about it. I knew that it was sort of bridging Endgame and the upcoming Doctor Who mysteries, the multiverse. The Doctor Strange, God, my doctors. I still want to see the crossover with Doctor Strange and Doctor Who, though. So I'm just throwing it out there. So
your writer available for hire. Yes.
Okay. I would write the crossover episode of anything that put Strange and Who together. That would be The Doctors Are In, would be the name of it. But at any rate, But I watched the first episode of WandaVision, and I grew up on that kind of TV. I was a huge fan of the Nick Van Dyke show. It's partly responsible for me thinking that writing for television could be fun until I started writing for television and discovered that Alan Brady is not a joke, that is actually how these people are. And you will find yourself working for an absolutely lunatic producer who may not talk to his hair pieces, but is one step away. So there are bad sides to that and good sides. But nonetheless, it was interesting. I liked the visuals. Watch the second episode. It was like,
cross
okay.
Between that and Bewitched.
Yes. Well, but the thing is the first two episodes hit all the media that I grew up with in the 60s and 70s. It was Bewitched. I Dream of Jeannie. It was Malcolm in the Middle, because they get to Malcolm in the Middle after the kids are born. But it was a slow fade of media that I'd grown up with.
The 70s show, Malcolm in the Middle, Brady Bunch, and all those, I was never familiar with. But one of the nice things is you really don't have to be.
No, because, but that's the best
in order
of
to
anything.
Recognize the tropes. I mean, episode one of WandaVision is entitled Filmed in Front of a Live Studio Audience. And
which it literally was.
It literally was. And, you know, they got the timing, they got the beats.
No, they did a perfect cloning of something. But the question became, well, why are they doing this? And by episode three, we know why. And it started going.
And you're getting tips. You're getting hints.
Oh, right, also, we should just say, anyone listening to this, massive spoiler alerts if you haven't watched these things yet. We're going to be talking about things that you should have seen before you listen to this.
This is a spoiler-filled show. The premise is at least for WandaVision and the second Marvel show, Falcon and the Winter Soldier, we're holding back nothing whatsoever.
Yes, and that will continue with Umbrella Academy, Doom Patrol, etc. So, getting back to WandaVision. So, here's the thing. I'm going to compress it down so we can go back and forth on it, but essentially what they managed to do was, and there were half-hour episodes, about 40 minutes because they had 10 minutes of credits or whatever, but they were, and basically hour with commercials. So if on broadcast. So they basically did these shows. There were what, 9 episodes? So we're talking like a 6 to 8 hour feature film that's a continuous story with a complete beginning, middle, and end that is can be completely self-contained. You wouldn't necessarily need to have seen what came before because they explain what came before and why this is happening. And you don't necessarily need to watch her after, though we will.
And let us be very, very, very clear. There will never be a WandaVision 2. There will never be a
Queen's Gambit. There is no reason for it.
These are totally... Now, Falcon and Winter Soldier, I don't know. But
that is going to continue because Sam is now Captain America, and there's a lot of story about that in the comic series. But more than that, the issues raised by him being Captain America feel like something they want to explore in greater depth as they did in the comics. One of the things I loved about that character going through that transition in the comics was that it is the time that the sad puppies were complaining about all the minority and diversity coming into their comics and why isn't it just the straight white men we grew up with? And my argument is always like, we haven't taken away anything. We've added things that we want to. And at some point there was no Captain America and then he came back. But ultimately Peter Parker's still there. Captain America's still there. All the white guy fantasy figures are still there. We just have other people, too, that the rest of us can identify.
I will tell you what I want as a follow-up instead of a Captain America or Falcon TV show. Dial it back 20, 25 years and give me a show with Isaiah. Suffice it to say that Terrence and I went on for at least another half hour, but we are out of time as far as broadcast is concerned. So what I'm going to do is cut some of the material that we had and record more with Terrence this week in order to make next Saturday morning's program, which is Juneteenth, relevant, because the Falcon and the Winter Soldier is very relevant. There are things regarding Watchmen and a few other shows that deal with racial issues. Finally, science fiction, TV shows, and comic book shows are catching up to our past.
You've been listening to Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you, Terrence Taylor, for joining us, and of course, Dan Persons for his movie review. And thank you for listening. Don't forget to support WBAI by making a pledge at 212-209-2950 or visiting give2wbai.org. We recommend the Buddy option. I'll be back next Saturday, which is Juneteenth, at 7 a.m. with something relevant to that date. In the meantime, stay tuned for Any Saturday with David Rothenberg. Good morning.
Good morning. You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI in New York. Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund came to you on recording over a listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. Coming up is Any Saturday with David Rothenberg at 8 o'clock. Please, stay tuned.
$10 a month. It's the price of a gigabyte of data for that iPad you never use. It's two overpriced coffees you ordered when you forgot to look at the menu. It's your overzealous attempts to meet the credit card minimum at the bodega on the corner. But $10 a month could be a lot more. Become a BAI buddy and commit to a recurring monthly donation to WBAI. This money will help us continue to broadcast the thoughts and perspectives of the progressive public. A BAI buddy is also not without perks. Your monthly contribution will earn you a WBAI tote bag and a member card offering Zipcar sales, discounted meals at select restaurants, and a handful of other benefits. You will also become a full voting member of WBAI, and our diverse programming will reflect your voice. Go to give2wbai.org and become a BAI buddy to support Free Speech Radio today.
You can now vote through July 7th, 11:59 p.m. in the Pacifica Foundation's bylaws referendum. Your ballot will be an e-ballot from vote@simplyvoting.com or a purple postcard with your voter ID and PIN beneath a scratch-off. You may get a paper ballot if you cast a paper ballot in the past. If you do not get your ballot, please file a ballot request form on elections.pacifica.org. If you do not have access to a computer, please leave a message for the election supervisor on 510-993-0320. It's 99.5 FM WBAI in New York and online at WBAI.org.
Extinction Diaries. The world's oceans are turning to acid. As carbon dioxide builds up in the atmosphere, the oceans ingest it in what scientists believe is a natural stabilization mechanism to balance the entire global ecosystem. The more carbon that dissolves in the oceans, the more acidic they become. And that is deadly for hard-crusted organisms like coral, shellfish, shrimp, lobsters, and microscopic creatures like plankton, the very foundation of our global food chain. In a bizarre twist, shipboard studies in the South China Sea are showing that increased acidity also makes diatoms and other phytoplankton vulnerable to energy they receive from sunlight. In a pH-balanced ocean, these same creatures thrive on sunlight, so sunlight and acidic waters are likely to increasingly accelerate population declines and extinction. Scientists say the world's oceans have not experienced a rapid acidic change such as what is happening today since about 60 million years ago. Although human-generated greenhouse gases did not exist then, we know that human activity like burning fossil fuels is making the situation worse. My name is Rising Moon, and this is a Small World Radio production.
Tune in to WBAI Playhouse this Saturday at 7 p.m. for two plays by feminist playwright Paula Vogel. First, How I Learned to Drive, for which Vogel received the Pulitzer Prize for Drama. The play is driven by issues of pedophilia, incest, and misogyny.
What does she need a college for? She's got all the credentials she'll need on her chest.
Maybe I want to learn things, read, rise above my cracker background.
Whoa, now, a little bit.
What kinds of things do you want to read?
There's a whole semester course, for example, on Shakespeare.
Shakespeare.
Then Baltimore Waltz. It's one of the very first plays about AIDS written by a woman to receive a major production.
The third stage. Bargaining.
Do you think if I let Elizabeth Kubler-Ross sit on my face, I'll get well?
The fourth stage. Depression.
That's two plays by Paula Vogel, Saturday evening, June 12th at 7 p.m. on WBAI Playhouse, right here on listener-sponsored, locally-controlled WBAI New York.
I wear a mask for my fellow New Yorkers.
My mama, who's a healthcare worker.
Nurses and doctors.
For my father.
For the marginalized communities who don't have access to adequate healthcare.
For my children.
My community.
Essential workers.
Transit workers.
The immunocompromised.
I wear a mask so we can get back to work.
Go to school, share a meal,
see a movie,
hug my friends,
dance together,
go to the theater,
see our families,
continue to show support,
take care of each other,
save lives,
stay strong.
Hi, this is Jerry Stiller. You are listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Where are my keys? Anybody see my keys? Who took my keys?
You've got to start off each day with a song. Now even when things go wrong, you feel better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong. If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day with a song.
Or sing it, Jimmy Boy.
Even when things go wrong,
sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you even look better. Ah, that music, it does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it. I got a million of them. Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day. Boys, please, soft, little more fortissimo. I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden or Odeo. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented. I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me. I ups to him, and without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologized. But the bull's not satisfied. He demands an autopsy. So I grabs him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail. I lands on his head. He flips his head. I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing. Just then, the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea. I start singing, south to the border, down Mexico way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull. He collapses. A cheer goes up. I'm saved. And the moral is, you gotta start off each day with a song. You've gotta start off each day with a song.
Oh boy, you're singing now.
Even when things go wrong.
Oh Jimmy, you're a wow.
You feel better. You know, I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal, hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? And he said, the same bunch, the wife and the kids. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
If you start off each day with a song,
Good morning. If you located this station by accident because you were just shuffling around with your radio, that was Jimmy Durante, which indicates that it is Saturday, a little after 8 o'clock. I'm here every week. I'm David Rothenberg, and the program is called Any Saturday. And you're listening to 99.5. If you were surfing, that's what you located. It's WBAI 99.5 FM, listener-sponsored radio in the city of New York. And I'm glad you found us. And if you find us every week, welcome back. It's June 12th. And I just had an orange, and I think something stuck in my throat. Took a walk this morning. It's beautiful out today. But I have to deal with the world. We're confronted with two conspiracy theories that are haunting our country. I like to tell you each week that as vaccinations go up, deaths go down, but that doesn't stop the conspiracy theory people from giving me all sorts of information, albeit in today's New York Times, there's a story that the FDA is looking again at the Baltimore plant where Johnson & Johnson has been making their vaccine. But that almost proves our point that the FDA is paying close attention. And if there is something that's questionable, they will attend to it. But the fabled fatalities that are circulating on the internet are absurd. I have the feeling, I've gotten the feeling that many of the conspiracy theorists who are against vaccinations almost hope that those of us who've gotten vaccinated will get sick or die, that their paranoia, their conspiracy theories are so great that they want to be proven right. And the only way they can is if we all succumb. And if we do, we won't be around to learn that you were right. So it's not a win situation for you. At the same time, my cousin was in Florida and he went past the northern part of Florida, saw big, big signs, and they all said the same thing. Trump won. They don't buy it. He lost by 7 million votes. He lost the Electoral College. He's a loser. He lost. But conspiracy theories have made the internet and the whole alternative information network. I'm ready to go back to carrier pigeons. Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is a man of science, said this week on television that most of the people who are gaining their misinformation on the internet, he said they are servants of very complicated scientific innovations, and that the discovery of a vaccine is much less complicated than that which they are slaves to, as they deny science, which is an interesting concept by a man who know something about the world and the stars. The sad news for me this morning is hearing that Herb Sturz passed away at the age of 90. The New York Times in there says he was. I knew Herb Sturz when the Fortune Society began. Herb was the head of the Vera Institute, started the Vera Institute, and was a mentor and a kind friend to me and to many others. It says Herbert Sturz, a self-taught expert in criminal justice and urban planning who profoundly but inconspicuously influenced public policy across a remarkably broad range of issues in New York City, died on Thursday. He was 90. And he died. His niece said that the cause was congestive heart failure. He was recuperating from a fall. It's about the fourth or fifth person who I knew in the last year who died as a result of complications after a fall. That's what happens to us oldies. We fall, and then we go bye-bye. Sam Roberts, very good profile on Herb Sturz. I love the last paragraph. Mr. Sturz achieved change through appointive posts. He lacked a discernible political power base to seek to elective office, had he been so inclined. For the most part, his constituency was confined to prisoners, the prostitutes, addicts, abused women, the underprivileged youth, the unemployed, the homeless, the poor, and the elderly, who never knew his name. Stunning. Herb Sturz, who was a quiet warrior in this great city of New York. And one of the musical treats in this town, a man named Joe Williams. I first heard Joe Williams when I was a mailboy at CBS 485 Madison Avenue. And there was they did live radio over on East 52nd Street. And the mailboys would, especially during lunch hours, would go over there for rehearsals. And the Basie Band was playing. And they had a new young singer in rehearsal. That's when I first heard Joe Williams. You're now going to hear him with a Rodgers and Hart song.
Falling in love with love is falling for make-believe. Falling in love with love is playing the fool. Caring too much is such a juvenile fancy. Learning to trust is just for children in school. I fell in love with love one night when the moon was full. I wasn't wise with eyes unable to see. I fell in love, with love everlasting. But love fell out with me. Fell in love with love one night when the moon was full. I was unwise with eyes unable to see. I fell in love with love, with love everlasting. But love fell out with me.
I became a Joe Williams fan the moment I heard him. I knew that he was special, and I knew that the Basie Band was very special. Here's a book review. Lara Bazelon's A Good Morning, published by Hanover Square, is a knockout, a five-star winner. It is at once a traditional thriller, a slam-bang courtroom drama, and at the same time, it's an up-to-date, in-your-face saga of a woman with lawyering skills and ambitions while navigating gender-specific parenting responsibilities. As a novelist in and around the courtroom, she recalls the best of Scott Turow and John Grisham, for she's also a chronicler of the presumptions and impositions faced by a 21st century woman. And with that, she is masterful, or if there's such a word, Ms.ful. Abby Rosenberg is Ms. Bazelon's LA-based protagonist, representing a young woman accused of killing her husband, who was a hard-drinking soldier. Both the lawyer and the accused are recent mothers. The trial of Liz Rivera Hollis has more shades than a float in a pride parade. It's clear that Abby would consider bypassing ethical and moral guidelines.